Welcome back, Question Medicine. 2019, this is Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. You know what time it is. It is, of course, time for Labor Day celebrations. And that also means it is time for another Questioning Medicine. So without further ado, without any hesitation, without any reservation, it is good to be back. All right, here we go. Question Medicine 2019, as I said in the intro, Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Let's just jump right into this podcast. We have a lot of articles to get to, but we can't get to any of them without getting into the first one. So this next article talks about the one thing that most men will go to the doctor for, and that, of course, is something and anything dealing with their penis. This article is titled Comparison of Harms, Advantages, and Costs Associated with Alternative Guidelines for Evaluation of Hematuria. Yep, that's true. If you are peeing blood, you are likely to go to the doctor. Man, woman, young, old, white, black. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because if you are peeing blood, you are likely to go to the doctor. However, there are many guidelines out there on what to do with hematuria. What do you do? I mean, what do you do? And which guidelines do you follow? And interestingly enough, I don't think that many guidelines actually look at their recommendations and say, what if these were applied on a global scale? What would happen? What would be the false positives? What would be the downstream effects of the recommendations that we're recommending? What would be the total cost to the whole medical system? But in this paper, the authors looked to see what were the harms and advantages of different hematuria guidelines, five different guidelines in total. It was the Dutch Canadian Urological Association, Kaiser Permanente, American Urological Association, and the Hematuria Risk Index. And each guideline had a different time for when they would recommend getting a CT urogram. Some do it on everyone. It doesn't matter their baseline risk. You need to get a CT urogram immediately. For example, the American Urological Guidelines say that all patients 35 years or older receive a cystoscopy and CT urogram. While some recommendations like Kaiser Permanente, you have to actually have very specific criteria to get the CT urogram. You just don't get everything. You don't get the whole gamut because you had one episode of hematuria. Now, they use individual patient data to do model simulations, but in the end, they found that if you pan-scanned everyone that came in with hematuria got a CT urogram, you did more harm compared to a renal ultrasound. The reason for this is that the CT scan is not benign. In fact, they found that if you just CT'd everyone, those low-risk patients, those patients that probably have nothing actually wrong with them, the CT group would then, when you're including everyone, have five times higher rates of secondary cancers and 10 times higher rates of urinary tract cancers caused by your CT urograms, caused by your pan scans, caused by you following what's currently in the guidelines. For me, that had to sink in for just a second. They're saying that the CT urogram, the one test that I'm ordering to diagnose cancer, is actually causing cancer. And I will grant you that, sure, ultrasound is not perfect. By no means is it perfect. It misses more renal cell carcinomas and more upper tract urethral carcinomas than the CT. But when it comes to bladder cancer, which is 85% of all hematuria evaluations, there was no difference between ultrasound and a CT urogram. There was no difference between the two in the one thing that makes up 85% of all hematuria evaluations. But the CT urogram does come with that increased risk of cancer. Like I said, 5 times higher rates of secondary cancer and 10 times higher rates of urinary tract cancer. Oh, and did you think really that ultrasound was going to be more expensive? No. Let's talk about money for just a second here. I'm going to quote right from the study. Among asymptomatic microscopic hematuria, this study found that replacing ultrasound with CT was associated with the detection of a single additional urinary tract cancer at an incremental cost per cancer detected of more than $6 million. Yep, you heard it here first. If you use CT instead of ultrasound, you are going to detect more cancers. There's no doubt about it. You will definitely do it, but at a cost of $6 million. The best available evidence suggests that uniform use of the CT for the initial evaluation of microscopic hematuria is ill-advised, says the authors, and this should be replaced with risk-based approaches and increased use of renal ultrasonography. In case you're wondering, the guidelines from Kaiser Permanente, only patients with a history of gross hematuria receive CT and cystoscopy. Smokers, males, and anyone 50 years or older receive cystoscopy and ultrasonography. And if you're a non-smoking female patient younger than 50 years old, you don't even undergo evaluation. In the end, I think this is going to change my practice because I can tell you from now on out, from here on out, from this day forward, a CT urogram will be the second test I order after an ultrasonography. So I think this just speaks that we all need to follow the guidelines, but not follow them blindly. Follow them after we think about them, because ultimately the goal is to do no harm. And blindly ordering CT urograms on everyone as recommended by the American Urological Association is doing more harm than good. Speaking of doing more harm than good, that is usually most studies and the paper that they waste. It does more harm to the environment than it actually does good in education to those individuals that read it. But that is not the case with this next study titled Perioperative Management of Patients with Atrial Fibrillation Receiving a Direct Oral Anticoagulant. You see, the question is, when you have a patient that has a DOAC, what do you do when the person has to go to surgery, an elective surgery at that? Do you bridge them? Do you not bridge them? Do you just start it? Do you just stop it? When do you start it? When do you stop it? What do you do? And that's exactly what this study set out to find. And I think we all know the big risk here. You see, if they're off the DOAC for too long, then boom, you got a stroke. And if you're on the DOAC for too long before you go to surgery, as in you don't stop it soon enough, well then, boom, you've got major bleeding happening. We want the sweet spot. What is the sweet spot? What's that magic number? Well, in this study, there was just over 3,000 patients with atrial fibrillation on apixaban, dabigatran, rivaroxaban, and they were all having an elective surgery. Now, in this, the CHADS2 score, it didn't matter because they were not bridging, they were just stopping, boom, stopping the medication. The DOAC regimens were omitted for 1 day before a low bleeding risk procedure and 2 days before a high risk bleeding procedure. Then at the time of surgery, they did a blood test to see how much of the factor 10A inhibitors were still in the bloodstream. That way they could go back later and say, well, it looks like for this drug, there was still 900 milligrams of factor 10A inhibitor, and for this drug, there was maybe none. But they drew the blood, but the surgeons and the medical team didn't have access to that information. So it wasn't going to stop the surgery. The surgery was still going to happen, but they were then able to go back retrospectively and say, well, did this person maybe bleed more than we thought? Well, look at that. It turns out they still had a bunch of factor 10A inhibitor in the bloodstream. The DOAC regimens were then resumed 1 day after a low risk bleeding procedure and 2 to 3 days after a high risk bleeding procedure. So just to put this in perspective here, if it's low-risk bleeding, we stop it 1 day before and we start it 1 day after. If it's high-risk bleeding procedure, then we stop it 2 days before and we start it 2 days after. Follow-up here was 30 days after the operation and post-operative rates of major bleeding were less than 2%, and the rates of stroke, they were less than 1%. That is pretty good numbers, and those are exactly the numbers that we care about. Now, let me go back to this factor 10A inhibitor in the bloodstream. That blood test they did before the surgery to see how much was left in the bloodstream. At time of surgery, almost 99% of all patients had minimal or no residual drug left in the bloodstream, which means, again, 1 day before, 1 day after for a low-risk surgery, 2 days before, and then restart 2 days after in a high-risk surgery. No need to bridge. No need to do anything fancy. Just stop it and then start it. And speaking of stopping and starting, what about stopping and starting new medications in patients that are in the hospital with high blood pressure? That is this next article from JAMA titled Clinical Outcomes After Intensifying Antihypertensive Medication Regimens Among Older Adults at Hospital Discharge. This was also an interesting study because you have a patient in the hospital, you're going to discharge them, and then the pharmacist or maybe the nurse says, doctor, this patient seems to have a high blood pressure. Should we add a medication? And then what do you do? What do you do? I mean, sometimes the systolic blood pressure is 180. Do you just send them home and say, hey, follow up with your primary care doctor? You're not having any symptoms. But that, I think, makes all of our sphincters tighten just a little because you don't want to be the one that sends them home with this crazy blood pressure and then they stroke out. Oh, well, in this study, greater than 50% of the individuals who had hypertension therapy intensified had at least three systolic 160 millimeters of mercury, and about 20% of them had at least three readings in the hospital of over 180 millimeters of mercury. This was just over 4,000 individuals all over the age of 65 with hypertension who were hospitalized, this is important, for non-cardiac conditions. 50% of them were pneumonia, 38% were UTIs, and 12% were venous thromboembolism. They were then propensity matched to look to see if intensification of their antihypertensive medication, so if you increased their blood pressure medication at discharge, was that associated with harms or side effects? And now I know that propensity matching is not the same as a randomized controlled trial. It doesn't account for all factors, but it is what we have, and they were using a national inpatient and outpatient VA pharmacy and clinical data, so you were able to get quite a bit of data here. Now, the three primary outcomes were pretty good. All-cause hospital readmissions within 30 days, medication-related serious adverse effects or events within 30 days, and cardiovascular events within 1 year. If you were one of the patients that were discharged with antihypertensive regimen intensification, meaning your blood pressure medication went up, your discharging hospitalist said, let's give you some more medication before you go to get down your high blood pressure that was seen here in the hospital, you had more or you were more likely to be readmitted within the next 30 days, a number needed a harm of 27. If you were discharged with antihypertensive regimen intensification, you were more, yes, again, more likely to experience an emergency department visit or hospitalization because of a side effect within the next 30 days, number needed a harm there, of 63. And I know what you're saying, or at least maybe I don't know what you're saying, but I know that I was saying. I said, well, yeah, maybe they're more likely to come back because of, a hypotensive event that causes syncope and collapse, and that's why they're more likely to come back to the ER. But what about the rates of stroke? What about the long-term benefits? If we're discharging these people with blood pressures of 180, I would suspect over time, maybe not over 30 days, because we know blood pressure doesn't work quite like that, but over a year, 6 months, you're going to see increased rates of stroke because some of those people aren't going to follow up. They're not going to go see their primary care doctor. The primary care doctor is not going to be aggressive enough. I mean, there's going to be something long-term here if we leave these untreated blood pressures, you would think, except for there was no difference. At 1 year, there was no difference in the cardiovascular events. This is likely because the blood pressure measurements around 1 year after discharge in the outpatient setting were almost exactly the same as those individuals who had intensification and who did not have intensification. Meaning at 1 year, once you were over your sick episode, it all really kind of worked itself out in the end. You were about back to baseline of a systolic blood pressure of 134 millimeters of mercury. I think in the end here, this just says if you're going to discharge someone and they're not having symptoms, let them follow up with a primary care doctor. There's no need for you as a hospitalist or an inpatient doctor to increase their medications. Have them follow up in a week or two when they're over their acute illness and have them check their blood pressure with their primary care doctor. 1 week is not going to do any harm. 2 weeks is not going to do any harm. 3 weeks is not going to do any harm. But if you increase their blood pressure medication, you are actually causing harm with a return to hospital visit, a return to hospital admissions, and an increase in the side effects. So I think you just let it be. Let it be, let it be, let it be. And speaking of let it be, I will let this be my last article. And the last thing that we're going to talk about is a listener question. Yep, listener question. And that's what we're going to do. This listener's name is Jake. He emailed me, which all of you can always do at any time. I'll be happy always to send you any resources, links, citations, whatever you need. It's okay. you can email me, AndrewBuelt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com, and I will always respond to you as quick as possible. Jake wrote in, he said, Andrew, great podcast as always. I was wondering if Advair would be just as effective as Symbicort, as Symbicort is not on my company's formulary drug list. I paraphrase that a little bit, but that's basically what he said. And so let's jump into this. Of course, Jake is talking about what I talked about last podcast, which was the GINA guidelines, the Global Initiative for Asthma, which basically came out in their new guidelines and said, listen, if you are talking about asthma, then for step one and step two, you should do budesonide formoterol. Budesonide formoterol, it is simple. It's Symbicort. That is what you should do. PRN, that's right. As needed, PRN, budesonide formoterol. And Jake is saying, listen, I don't have budesonide formoterol, Symbicort. It's not so simple for me, you see. So could it be possible that I could go ahead and just use Advair? And the short answer here is no. No, you cannot. And I will get into why you cannot, why those are not interchangeable. I initially thought to myself, hey, you probably could, actually. I don't see why you couldn't. And then I went and read the literature. And now I will break down the literature for you so you will also know why there is no way you can use PRN Advair. While it is only Symbicort, budesonide formoterol, it is not Advair PRN. So let's be very clear here. The GINA guidelines, these global initiative guidelines, they say it is PRN, budesonide formoterol, for step one and step two. They also say step one, a other option or non-preferred, but other option is low-dose inhaled corticosteroids taken with the SABA. So if you are, let's say, with a company that doesn't have formulary of Symbicort, budesonide formoterol, then step one, you would do low-dose inhaled corticosteroids with their albuterol. PRN, if you're going to take one, you take the other. If you're going to take the other, you take the one. You get what I'm saying? For step two, it is a tide. Preferred controllers here is a tide. It is either the PRN, Symbicort, or it is daily low-dose inhaled corticosteroids plus a PRN albuterol. So PRN, budesonide formoterol, or daily inhaled corticosteroids. Now, this comes from the Sigma-2 trial, which I'm going to talk about here in a second, but basically, the PRN, budesonide formoterol, did just as good when we're talking about exacerbations in the Sigma-2 trial as those individuals that were on scheduled treatment. And because, as you can imagine, with Symbicort being PRN, you're not getting the daily inhaled corticosteroids. In fact, not only were you not getting the daily amount, you got about 75% less. We definitely know that there are side effects associated with corticosteroids or inhaled corticosteroids. They're not a ton, but they're there. And so if we can avoid them and we're having the same difference in exacerbations, then why would we not do that? And I'll get to the Sigma-2 trial in just a second. Now, why can we not use Advair? Why can that not happen? Well, I went back to the article in the New England Journal of Medicine 2016 titled Safety of Adding Salmeterol to Fluticasone in Children with Asthma. This was the FDA mandated, you got to do this because we are afraid that these LABAs are killing people trials. This was children 4 to 11 years with a history of asthma exacerbation. There was just over 6,000 children randomized to fluticasone plus salmeterol or just fluticasone for 26 weeks, and they all had scheduled or PRN albuterol. Now, the authors used a non-inferiority trial here, which is totally fine because that's probably what you should use if you're doing a trial that the FDA is making you do. You're not trying to show superiority at this point. You're just trying to say, hey, listen, it's good enough and it's not necessarily killing people. They were looking at the serious adverse events here of hospitalization, intubation, or asthma due to death. Interestingly enough, there were no intubations and there were no asthma-related deaths here. So the only harms that we have from this 26-week trial are from hospitalization. And they used very generous margins. For this particular non-inferiority trial, they put the confidence interval, the upper bound of the confidence interval for this, at 2.675. Basically, they were saying if the upper bound of this 95% confidence interval is less than 2.675, then everything is A-OK here. Everything is fine. Don't worry about us. We're just fine. The problem with that is, not to be super nerdy, but every point that you're above one, that's considered basically one patient. So one and one means that they are the exact same drug. But let's say you have one versus 1.10. That means 10 patients are being harmed, potentially being harmed, with this drug. When you have 2.675, well, that's 167.5 patients are potentially being harmed. That is a huge confidence interval, and there is very few times in which we look at a drug and we say, hey, listen, we know that it's probably, you know, it's no better, it's no worse, it's non-inferior, and we're willing to accept harm up to 167 people, because that's what a 2.67 confidence interval range means. I know that this can lose people in a podcast, but basically, when you're going above or below one, you got to think of each individual little number above or one is being one person. So again, one is zero, but if it's 1.05, then that means you're harming five people. 1.10 means you're harming 10 people. 1.20, you're potentially harming 20 people. Hopefully that makes sense. Now, in the study, they found that there was 27 asthma-related hospitalization in the combination therapy and 21 in the fluticasone-only group, which met their criteria for non-inferiority, except the confidence interval was 0.73 up to 2.27, meaning for that particular run, you can say that it is possible Advair helped 27 people, which is the 0.73, or you can say that it potentially harmed 127 people, which is the 2.27. Yep, that's right. Helped 27 or hurt 127. I know that this met non-inferiority, but which one would you rather have? If I said, hey, you can have this drug, or in this drug in the trial, based on the way we ran the numbers and compared it to each other, they're actually non-inferior. And all I can tell you is that this drug actually might be better. This Advair drug might be better, and it might help 27 patients. But also in the same study, I can tell you that it might be worse and could have harmed 127. We don't really know. Which one would you rather have? Of course you would say, excuse me, those are not equal. Those are not comparing apples to apples, oranges to oranges, loaves of bread to loaves of bread. I mean, my goodness. But there was no difference also in the rates or the likelihood of experiencing a severe exacerbation. It was 8.5% versus 10%. The confidence interval here was 0.73 to 1.01. Yes, that is right. It barely crossed the line of no significance. 1.01. So likely, there could be harm here. There actually could be real harm here. And we just mathematically, statistically squeaked out a win at 1.01. Now, that was in children, which is the important thing, because I think children are the main individuals that have asthma, or at least adolescents that have asthma. There was one more study titled Serious Asthma Events with Fluticasone plus Salumeterol versus Fluticasone Alone. This was 11,000 patients that did exactly what you said, what the title said. The mean age was 43. The primary endpoint was first severe asthma exacerbation, and there did seem to be a benefit here. There were fewer asthma exacerbations in the Advair group than in the group that just received fluticasone alone, 8% versus 10%, number needed to treat of 50 over 26 weeks. But again, this is in 43-year-olds. I believe that the reason that we see probably benefit here is that because towards middle age or 40-some, 50-some years old, there tends to be this line of COPD and asthma in combination. And so what's the true benefit? And the other problem is asthma, we know, part of the reason the PRN medications work is because asthma tends to wax and wean. It tends to come and go. You can tend to have some exacerbations, and then you tend to be doing really well. You seem to be really bad for a couple months, and then you, again, will get a lot better. So I don't think that you can use Advair. It's just not there. Again, the Sigma 2 trial, which is the reason this GINA guidelines are made, the number 2 trial was 4,000 patients randomized either twice daily budesonide plus as needed terbutaline, or it was just as needed budesonide and formoterol for 52 weeks. The as-needed budesonide formoterol was non-inferior to the scheduled or maintenance twice-daily budesonide for the prevention of exacerbations. And because, again, you're using a PRN, it was 75% less inhaled corticosteroid. However, in those individuals that were on the twice-daily budesonide, they did have better symptom control, better quality of life, and pre-bronchodilator FEV1 was better. The things we really care about, the things the patients really care about, the exacerbations, well, that was no different. So they say, listen, have the conversation. You're not going to be wrong if you schedule them on inhaled corticosteroids twice a day. That's not the wrong answer here. In fact, again, by the guidelines, it's actually equal. And by the studies, they're going to have better symptom control and better quality of life. They just may not have better quality of life when they're taking their inhaler twice a day as compared to the PRN with budesonide famotidine. Whew, that was a lot. That covered a ton. I'm going to end there. If you have any questions, you can always email me, AndrewBuelt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com. So let's wrap this one up like we wrapped every single one before it. So in 30 seconds or less, let's try to wrap up all of the articles so far. First of all, not all guidelines are created equal. So think for yourself. Critically appraise the guidelines because some guidelines, if you actually apply them to a mass population, will do more harm than good. Now, speaking of more harm than good, DOACs will do more harm than good if you leave them on for too long before surgery. So if it's a low-risk surgery, stop the DOAC one day prior to surgery and then restart it one day after surgery. If it's a high-risk surgery, then you stop it 2 days prior to surgery and restart the medication 2 days after surgery. It is easy peasy, lemon squeezy. Now, in patients that come into the hospital for a non-cardiac condition and subsequently have a high blood pressure, don't worry about it. There is no evidence for harm with 1 week of high uncontrolled blood pressure, but we do have evidence that starting medication while in an acute state or an acute unstable sick condition will cause harm. So in the end, just let it be. And finally, the GINA guidelines. It should be simple. Symbicort, budesonide famotidine, PRN for stage one and stage two. However, if you don't have that, if that is not formulary for you, then for stage one, the other option is every time the patient takes their SABA, they're also then taking their inhaled corticosteroid. No more ever SABAs just by themselves. That's stage one. Stage two, again, it should be simple, simple, Symbicort, budesonide famotidine, PRN, or you do scheduled inhaled corticosteroids twice a day with a PRN SABA. There we go. There you have it. There it is. Let's wrap this up and wait for the music. And until next time, keep the quest and questioning.